The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Ann Jordan for the North Carolina Reading Service, and welcome to Oprah Magazine. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from oprahmag.com. Kamala Harris got the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine live on TV. Vice President-elect Kamala Harris received the first dose of the COVID-19 vaccine on Tuesday. It was on live TV, and she was urging viewers to get vaccinated to save lives. The Vice President-elect received the first shot of the Moderna vaccine at United Medical Center in Washington, D.C., administered by clinical nurse manager Patricia Cummings. "That was easy," Harris told Cummings after receiving the vaccine in her left arm. "Thank you. I barely felt it." "I want to encourage everyone to get the vaccine. It is relatively painless. It happens really quickly. It's safe," she said. "It's literally about saving lives. I trust the scientist. And it is the scientist who created and approved this vaccine. So I urge everyone, when it is your turn, get vaccinated." All right, this next article is called Single on Valentine's Day. Here are some things to do that are better than a prefix dinner. Rationally, you know that being single on Valentine's Day is not the end of the world. And yet, if you're like most people, you also probably feel at least a hint of sadness, annoyance, or even anxiety when you come across all those sappy diamond ring commercials, bundled love letters in the park, bouquets of roses being sold on nearly every street corner, and the seemingly endless shelves of mouth-watering heart-shaped truffles. But here's the thing. Even though February 14th can feel like an occasion that's just meant for couples, there are plenty of reasons why it's actually good to spend Valentine's Day single. For starters, you can celebrate the holiday exactly as you want to, meaning you don't have to worry about picking out a great gift or shelling out a lot of money on the perfect date. Instead, you can do whatever it is that makes you happy. One thing you can do is reconvene with your long-lost creative pastime. That old keyboard, you know, the one you haven't touched in months or years? Pull it out from hibernation and make a date with your creativity. Make a spread of snacks to feed your soul. Most times call for foods that nourish your body, but other times call for the ones that feed your soul, like the bowls of buttery popcorn you passed around with your siblings as a child, or homemade candies your grandmother brought to every family gathering. Make a buffet of comforts that call upon your most tender memories, ones that fill you with happiness and warmth. Another nice thing to do is call someone who adores you, whether it's your mom, your childhood best friend, or your niece, an engulfing conversation with someone who genuinely loves you. No mask, no reservations. It can soften those calloused corners of your heart and mind. Sink into an evening of self-pampering. Let the bathtub become your sanctuary. Fill it with fizzy balms, lots of bubbles, scented salts, or stress-busting essential oils. Relax into a cushioned back pillow. Apply a hydrating face mask. Read a new romance novel. Have some wine and chocolate. You could volunteer your time and talents, whether at your local hospital, nursing home, or neighborhood animal shelter. Lean into what you're passionate about and offer the gift of compassionate service. Another idea is to work out. Get your heart racing this Valentine's Day thanks to a little sweat session. Whether you go for a run or a long walk or you take a class, you'll not only step up your fitness game, but you'll also give yourself the ultimate Valentine's Day gift, mood-boosting endorphins. Finish that big idea you've been procrastinating. You know that undeveloped project that's been dangling just out of reach or collecting dust in the almost-done pile? Today is a shining opportunity to lure it into fruition. Dr. Gilliland says that procrastination feeds feelings of hopelessness, but that pushing past it can have the opposite effect. Procrastination leads to frustration, making you feel like you keep returning to square one. The solution is to find new and creative ways to enhance your productivity, whether it's setting dates and writing them on your calendar, or adjusting your goals to find your momentum. Whatever the goal, you will revel in the rush of self-confidence that comes with completing something that you have been longing to actualize. Imagine how awesome it's going to feel to give yourself that triumphant high five. You could check out a comedy show. Laughter is medicinal. There are mountains of data to support this relieving effect on anxiety and depression, which is why it can't get much better than a comedy show on Valentine's Day, when comedians are sure to serve up a bevy of uproarious tales about the most heinous of their ex-lovers. The Second City offers a variety of weekly online shows. Denver's Comedy Works is live streaming select performances, and Nowhere Comedy Club has an impressive lineup of stand-ups nearly every night. Of course, you can also skip the live part entirely and stream specials from some of the best comedians on Netflix. Another great thing to do is make a confidence-boosting playlist. Skip the lovesick, forlorn ballads and fill it with energizing anthems, songs of liberation, and uplifting music from your favorite artist, whether that's Dolly Parton, John Legend, or Alicia Keys. Okay, here's another interesting tip. Write a letter of advice to yourself. What would the future version of you ask that you stop obsessing about or be spunky enough to reach for? Whether you're 19 or you're 65, pull out that special book and give your future self the opportunity to remind you to focus on the positive. Think of something outrageously fun. Your life could change tomorrow, and your life could look entirely different a year from now. So what if you knew that this Valentine's Day was your last one to ever fly solo? What would you do? What would most thrill you? Do that. Or do that thing that your ex loved to complain about. Did your ex refuse to join you for Korean barbecue, or groan every time you turned up the volume on Beyoncé's Homecoming album? Bask in the freedom of being able to do all of the above without any snarky comments. There is no lover standing in the way of enjoying your favorite things now, because this is your independence. This next article is by Oprah. She says, "My favorite part of any conversation, on air or off, is when someone has a revelatory moment and utters these words, 'I never thought of it that way before.'" Case in point, Joanne Compton, whose daughter Lori Ann was murdered in 1988. For the next 10 years, this grieving mother didn't change a single thing in her daughter's room. A decade later, she was mourning her death as though she had just passed away. Her plan was to share Lori Ann's story on the Oprah show and then go home and kill herself. But when Joanne came on, Dr. Phil, in one awe-inspiring instant, changed everything. He said to her, "Your daughter lived 18 vibrant and wonderful years, yet you're focusing on the day of her death rather than celebrating the event of her life." I could see Joanne process that thought, and then the light bulb moment. "I never thought of it that way before," she cried. Getting people to be open to seeing things differently has been my life's work. I love when it happens to me, too. I once interviewed a group of women who were in prison for killing their children. When we finished, one of the inmates said, "You are the first person who's come in here and talked to us like we were normal women, not just murderers. How could you do that?" My response? "I could feel your pain, and I recognize that all pain is the same. We just chose different ways to release it. This is what you chose to do with yours. You killed your children." Unspeakable. The depths of that crime, the horror, the shame. But my ability to set aside my preconceived notions and see those women as hurting human beings gone wrong, not monsters of evil, as some had been labeled in the press, This changed the way I viewed everyone. I started to see that everybody's just doing the best they know how to do. And that even when they know better but can't do better, they often wish they could. What if you were willing to see your whole life differently, from the 35,000-foot view? What if you could see everything you've been through, everything you've stood up to, every time you've fallen and rebounded, every curveball you were thrown and caught, every time you were disappointed and didn't stoop to despair, every victory, every chance, and appreciate the fact that you're still here, still standing, still striving for a better life? I hope you give yourself a round of applause for making it this far, and then see yourself as a part of the whole of this planet. What gifts have you to offer? What was your reason for coming? What I know for sure, the answers keep unfolding as your life expands, if you're willing to see things for what they are and what they can be. All right, this next article is about Trevor Noah. It's called Trevor Noah Tells Oprah What He Learned From His Gangster Mom. He says, "She's the example I live my life by." Trevor Noah's story is so implausible. It's almost like a fable. Mixed-race boy grows up in poverty amid the ruthless oppression of apartheid South Africa and ends up behind the desk at one of our most beloved TV institutions. After finishing his soul-stirring 2016 memoir, Born a Crime, I knew I needed to sit down with the Daily Show host to absorb more of his warmth and wisdom. How did the 34-year-old make his way into acting, a career in stand-up, and a coveted late-night role in which he mocks the outrageousness of our current political climate? With more than a little help from his mother and the audacity of someone with nothing to lose. Okay, here's the interview. Oprah says, "I'm so happy you're here." He said, "Thank you so much for having me." In your book, you told your story with such humor, depth, sincerity, and truth. I've never heard of a comedian who grew up in apartheid South Africa under such extreme conditions, then turned that into comedy. My whole life, comedy has been a tool I've used to process pain. And you've seen how we live in Soweto. Yes. Being poor sucks, but being poor together makes it a lot better. My family had something that sometimes you don't have when you have too much, the ability to focus on the human beings around you. We had each other, so we laughed. Your description of apartheid is one of the best I've heard. You wrote, "It was a police state, a system of surveillance and laws designed to keep black people under total control. In America, you had the forced removal of the native onto reservations, coupled with slavery, followed by segregation. Imagine all three of those things happening to the same group of people at the same time. It was illegal for a European to cohabitate, to have sex, to have carnal intercourse with any person of another race. So by being mixed race, you were literally born a crime." Right. Everyone was separated, black and white, and even smaller groups within races. The system was designed to make sure every group was oppressed. And when you were a little boy, your family had to hide you, because you could have been taken from them. Yeah, and I didn't know. As a kid, they'd sometimes tell me to go hide under the bed. In my mind, I had the coolest parents. Sometimes I go hide. Only when I was writing the book did my grandmother tell me, "Oh yes, we hid you, because the police would come, and if they found you, they would have taken you away." I was evidence that my parents had broken the law. I was like, how did I not know this my entire life? And my grandmother goes, "You never ask." Tell the story of the time you went to a new school. When I went to my first public school, I took a placement test, and they put me in a class with only white kids. I didn't think that was abnormal until I went to recess, and a flood of black children came out of nowhere. They said they were in another class, and I said, oh, I want to be there. My teacher said, that's not the smart class. If you move there, the rest of your life may not go in the direction you want it to. Well, I chose to go into the black class, and I'm sitting next to Oprah right now. The thing that really got me about your book is that, as one review I read put it, it's a love letter to your mother. Completely. Your mom is one badass warrior woman. She knew it was against the law to be with a white person, and she said, I'm doing it anyway. I'm going to have a child and raise him the way I want. Noah said, most people would have a sign to protest government oppression. My mother had me. In writing this book, I never thought it was about my mom. Most of us believe we're the hero of our own story. But I realized I was always my mother's sidekick. She stood up at a time when many people were afraid to, when a country was being punished for standing up. She said, I will live the way I believe. And she did. She's the example I live my life by. For me, she's one of the most gangster human beings. Oprah said, oh yeah, your mother is gangster. In the book you say that the highest rung of what's possible is far beyond the world that you can see. You're the only famous person I've interviewed that I can remember who grew up poorer than I did. I mean, the fact that we can talk outhouses. Noah said, that's an experience most people cannot understand fully, growing up with an outhouse. It's a humbling experience. It's like bungee jumping. I'm glad I did it, but I don't want to do it again. Oprah says, how many bathrooms do you have now? He said, I have 3 in America. I've got 3 more back home in South Africa. I'm bawling out of control right now. Oprah said, so I want to know how you ended up on The Daily Show. That was so surreal. I was in London, touring the world for the first time, doing comedy, my lifelong dream. My phone rings with an American number, and a voice says, hi, can I speak to Trevor Noah? This is Jon Stewart. I'm not thinking it's the Jon Stewart, so I said, Jon Stewart from... And he said, oh, sorry, I host The Daily Show in America. I'm a big fan of your comedy. Oprah said, where had he seen you? Noah says, on YouTube. Of course. He said, would you like to come to America, pop into the show, and hang out? And funnily enough, I said no. You said no. I knew I would have to cancel shows and people had bought tickets to come see me. I don't take my fans for granted. John said, well, when you do come to New York, look me up and let's hang out. 1.5 years later, that's what I did. Oprah said, even though you got the call that some people wait their entire lives for, you had a responsibility to and a respect for your fans. Your mama raised a really good son. So were you surprised when they chose you to host? I was, because I come from a world where there was no chance for me. Every chance I've taken is the one that's impossible. But I always say to people, why do the possible thing? It's boring if you succeed. Try the impossible thing. I thought, I'll throw my name in, and if I don't get The Daily Show, I was never meant to get it. What is your intention with the show? It's not just about the funny, right? He said, I think in many ways it is about the funny for me. But I've come to realize, partly by speaking to comedians who have been mentors and friends, Dave Chappelle, Chris Rock, and Eddie Murphy, the truth is where the funny lies. For me, in pursuing the funny, I pursue the truth. I'm somebody who loves engaging in the news, discussing ideas, engaging in debate. Oprah said, do you feel you've hit your stride? He said, I'm always trying to be better. I'm always unsatisfied. Sometimes the show is a catharsis for me and the people watching. Sometimes it's a place for us to enjoy laughter. Sometimes it's a place for us to learn. I've realized there is no fixed point. I'm aiming for a true north, but it's shifting with the tide. I'm constantly trying to keep the boat where it needs to go versus where I thought it should go. Oprah said, and you have to let it guide you. You allow it to take you where it needs to go. He said, I'm trying. It's my great pleasure and delight to meet you. My honor. Thank you so much. Now I'm going to read a short story about an office worker who is being stalked by her ex. This is called Hotline Girl, and it's by Taiping Chen. Before I dive into the story, I'm going to read a little description here. It says, set in an alternative modern China, Taiping Chen's riveting and idiosyncratic story, Hotline Girl, centers on a young woman working at the government satisfaction office, fielding calls from distressed customers. It's a job that's somehow both mundane and stressfully fast-paced, much like the well-crafted story itself. It's also surrounded by sadness. By turns, emotional and suspenseful, Hotline Girl is, above all, about a woman learning to embrace her own power. And here it is. The highways were adorned with thousands of roses each spring. They came in bright pinks and butter yellows, perfect potted visions in the center meridian. The annual choreography of thorns and petals usually came in April, after the winter gloom lifted. During those dark and choking months, the authorities painted the roads a luminous yellow. For better cheer and energy during the gray. The bulletins came like that, dozens of them a day. Attention, they said. This afternoon, short hair kittens. And they would appear on screen, big pawed and blinking, and commuters would look up and smile. Attention, how maple syrup is made. A man in a stark forest, drilling into a tree, gray vats of boiling liquid. Attention, the ginkgo leaves are turning gold around Nanshan Park. Come see. And so on. When Bei stepped out that morning, like every morning, she slipped a red lanyard with her identification card around her neck. The lanyard's color confirmed her status as a resident of the city, hard won after years of jobs at its margins. The card had her picture and name and work unit on it. Anyone entering the city had to wear one. Each card synced with the city's sensors and recorded the bearer's activity. At the end of the day, you could log on and see the number of miles you'd walked. I'm going on a highway. I'm going on a lightning bolt, she sang as she walked to the subway. For years, she'd wanted to be a singer, tried to make her voice strong. The way she wanted it to be, tried to write a breakout hit. They were short melodies, just a few refrains repeated on a loop. She couldn't seem to figure out how to write a full one, chorus, verse, bridge. The trains were packed that morning. All the trains piped in classical music at rush hour. It was supposed to soothe tempers, but everyone pushed and elbowed one another anyway. Bei distrusted it instinctively. All those long, meandering phrases, it felt like cheating. She wanted her music precise, to have a point. When she'd pushed her way through the crowds, up the elevator 7 floors and into the office, she could see the oily bristles of Kiao Ying's hair over his screen. I had a plumber come this morning, she said, shrugging, as he stood and frowned at her. They're always running late. She didn't apologize. She'd realized early on that apologies were the surest way for Kiao Ying to decide that you were soft fruit, easily picked on. The other girls didn't get that. They kept their eyes lowered, almost invisibly leaning away as he passed their stations. One girl would spring up and hide in the bathroom any time he approached their corridor, the one that bore a sign saying, Hotline Girls. We've already had 27 calls, her friend Suki whispered to her. They both looked automatically at the girl sitting at the rose end and sighed. The girl, Zhao Mei, had been picked as this year's office model worker. It wasn't clear why, except that she had pleasing features and long hair that fell in a silky black rain about her face. For months, her glowing image had blanketed the subway and billboards across town. Warm, gentle, capable. Government workers can help you resolve any question, any concern. Call the satisfaction office today. 12579. When the switchboard pinged, no one looked to Jun Mei anymore. Ever since her award, she'd been slack, creating more work for the other girls. All calls had to be answered within 45 seconds. It meant that while June May was sitting idly with her headset on, Bay and the others were scrambling, picking up, pressing hold, picking up, muttering, pressing return on their keyboards, typing fast. When she first came to the city, Bay had worked for a time in fast food. It was that same complicated kind of dance, keeping 10 orders in your head simultaneously, twirl, turn about, begin again. The switchboard pinged again as Bay opened up her chat screen and faced a barrage of pop-ups. The easiest thing was to send a smiley face. She started all of her conversations that way. There were set programmed keys for smiley faces, and another key that spat out, "Hello, Satisfaction Office. What can I help you with?" The switchboard kept pinging, the big timer with its red numerals counting down. If no one picked up by the time the number hit zero, a buzzer sounded, and everyone's ratings were docked. Still, the other girls didn't budge. They were waiting for her to take the call. Everyone knew she had just arrived. She jerked on her headset guiltily. "Hello, Satisfaction Office. What can I help you with?" A swarm of words enveloped her ear, a raspy connection. It sounded like the person was dialing from a rooftop on a windy day. "Excuse me, I didn't catch that. You want a house? I'm sorry, please restate the matter? You've been evicted?" She was guessing now half the time she could fill in the blanks. There were complaints about corrupt officials, questions about social subsidies. There were all the lonely people who dialed the government day after day, wanting to talk, the elderly or mentally infirm, many with complaints that would never be resolved. One mother called regularly to inquire about a daughter who had gone missing 10 years before. Kidnapped, she was sure. One agitated man called their office for months, complaining there were termites in the tree opposite his building. He was convinced they'd get into the wires and electrocute the neighborhood. They'd sent an inspector who'd found nothing. They'd sent someone who had pretended to spray, to set his heart at rest, but it didn't satisfy him. At last, they'd sent someone to chop the whole thing down, and he stopped calling. "Excuse me, not a housing? You want to report someone?" "An unregistered kitchen knife. Let me take that down." She began typing, simultaneously pressing the button for "Tell me more" on 4 different windows that popped up. One woman was complaining about a court verdict, saying the judge was related to the defendant. Another man claimed authorities were illegally taxing his restaurant. A senior said he hadn't been getting the rise in pension payments he was owed. Her shoulders were starting to ache and she rubbed her eyes, staring out at the sea of computers around her. It always surprised her how quickly time passed, taking down notes, sending links, marking case urgency by color. A few times, Bay routed red compassion packets to callers just to smooth things over. There was a common budget for that, for the particularly obstreperous cases who refused to hang up. "I'm going to report you to our supervising agency." "Oh, I just received a notification. Thank you for your good intentions. No, I know you were only trying to help." It was astonishing how many residents just needed to feel they'd extracted something, anything, from the other end of the line, even if it was only 10 or 20 yuan. At noon, the delivery man arrived outside and unloaded 200 boxed lunches, white containers of rice or noodles with vegetables and shredded pork. The options were nearly identical, but everyone crammed the narrow hall in a frantic rush anyway, the grease turning the cardboard orange and translucent. As they waited, Suki stretched out her leg and showed off one boot, and Bay squealed, "You got them!" "I did," Suki said proudly. "Do you think I'm crazy?" "A little," Bay said. The boots were knitted from soft brown leather, studded with whorls of tiny seashells, and cost a month's salary. Suki had the office's highest bonus. Her satisfaction rate was extraordinary, and she almost never got repeat callbacks. It wasn't because she used the red packets, either. There was just something so reasonable and capable in Suki's manner. She never argued, and had an encyclopedic knowledge of the government's workings, knew just what resources she could offer, was genuinely good at helping people. She was a hard worker, too, In the evening, she picked up extra shifts working in transport. The call came around 2 p.m. when they'd settled back into their stations, into that midday stretch when calls ebbed and it was hard to keep your eyes open. One of the girls on the line kept a spray bottle nearby, periodically misting her face to stay awake. Bay was feeling lazy, dealing with some chats by simply sending a nodding face, which brought another minute before you had to reply again. The switchboard pinged, and Bay waited until the timer showed 10 seconds left, then punched firmly and straightened up. "Hello, Satisfaction Office, what can I help you with?" There was silence. She spoke again, impatiently. "Hello?" And, "Hello?" Bay frowned into the receiver. Occasionally, very rarely, you'd get a heavy breather. Sometimes they might say inappropriate things. Ask what you were wearing, if you were married, had a boyfriend. She was about to hang up when she heard a voice. "Wow, at last." "I'm sorry? Bay, it's me." She sat back, pulled her headset away for a moment, and cupped her earpiece, eyes closed. Then, when she'd composed herself, she put it back again. "Yes, sir. Why are you... I mean, please state the matter," she said. "I called probably 60 times already today," he said. "I wasn't sure I'd ever get you." She looked around to the other girls on the line and spoke neutrally. "Is there something I can help you with?" There was silence. "Is that it?" he said. "This is a government line," she said coldly. "Is there a matter that requires assistance?" "Yes," he said. "I wish you would see me. I'm here. I'm standing outside." Bay hung up automatically, the way one might drop a shoe at the sight of a cockroach scuttling outside. She breathed in, went back to her screen, and picked up 2 more calls in a hurry. An abused wife, a man complaining about trash in his neighborhood. At 5 p.m., she slipped the lanyard about her neck again and exited through the service elevator around the back, moving fast, trying not to be seen. She went home shakily, fixed herself a meal. She felt agitated. She finally went to pace outside for a while before sitting on the bench opposite the trash cans. After 20 minutes, one of the alley cats came up and snaked itself into her lap, and she petted it automatically. She stared into the bushes accusingly, as though they might conceal someone watching her. "The next day," he called again. "It was too much," he said. "I shouldn't have come over. I was just so excited to have found you." She cleared her throat. "I wasn't lost." "No, of course not," he said. They were both silent. He had never been good at making conversation, she remembered. Sometimes they'd eat their meals together in almost complete silence, which oddly never seemed to bother him. She relaxed a little. There had always been an art to being around Kiju. It meant turning off your mind, like lifting weights or falling asleep. It didn't feel as bad as it sounded. It was important to be strong. It was important to sleep. You both needed to stay alive. "You're here," she said. "I mean, I know you were yesterday. Are you visiting, or..." The city was 32 million people, none of whom were Kiju. He should have been 600 miles away. "Just visiting," he said hastily, to reassure her. They were silent again, and she watched her screen light up and flash. "Oh, I really can't talk now," she said. "Don't hang up," he said. "It took me 2 hours to reach you today. Isn't there a direct line I could call, so that I know you'll pick up?" "It doesn't work that way." "You are the Satisfaction Office, aren't you?" he said, trying to make a joke of it. "I'm not going to be satisfied until I get to talk to you." She silently clicked over to another call and transferred it to the government's legal division. A few minutes later, he was still there. "I do have complaints, you know," he said. "I could tell you about them." "Fine." She opened a form. "They tore down the old schoolhouse," he said. "They brought in a wrecking ball." She knew the building, could picture it. He'd brought her there shortly after they'd started dating on their first trip together to his old village. It was a small, abandoned schoolhouse, just two rooms, something out of a historical old photograph. They'd wandered it, hand in hand, their voices strange in the empty rooms. For months afterward, they used it as their private meeting spot. No one attended school in places like that anymore. Actually, no one really lived in places like that anymore, with their bad roads and tiny, dried-out plots of cultivated land. By the time he was growing up, Kaju's family was one of the last holdouts, poor and very proud. "I don't remember it," she lied. "Are you sure?" he said, and his voice was teasing. "I know I do." She felt the heat rise in her cheeks. "Not a real complaint," she said. "Next?" "I just want to see you, Bay." She made a noncommittal noise. "Huh." "I have another," he said. "Okay." She sent a smiley face to a new chat. She copied the instructions on how to file a whistleblower report into another window that was flashing repeatedly and hit send. "My parents aren't doing well," he said. "My father's spirits have been bad ever since we relocated. I think the government should do something about it." "Like a doctor?" "Not like a doctor. He's seen doctors."
"Like what, then?"
"I was thinking compensation." She raised her eyebrows. This was new. Kaju's family had been relocated from the countryside a decade ago, when he was 14, to a city 20 miles west of their old home. It wasn't far, but it might as well have been another nation. It was a million people living in closely set blocks, with bus lines and supermarkets. It was parks with water features that lit up and sprayed arcs on the hour. It was where the two of them had met, back when they were in high school. "I'm sorry to hear he's not doing well," she said, and she was. She had always liked Kaju's father. He was obsessed with collecting gourds. He had started the habit back in their village and in the city where he struggled to find work. It had become a fixation. Their apartment had two black bookshelves filled almost wholly with gourds, big ones like water bottles, small ones like toy tops, a few painted, others carved, some he'd carved himself. "There's a 2-year statute of limitations for petitions on relocation compensation," she said, frowning a little. "You might try one of the spirit management committees. They often have subsidies he could apply for." "You should call his local satisfaction office," she said. "They'll help you." "Thank you," he said. "I'm sorry I can't do more," she said, and meant it. She had liked his family. She liked the way his mother made their kitchen fragrant, dicing red and green bell peppers into pixels, mixing them with ground pork and bits of chopped vermicelli for lunch. She liked the way his father knew the seasons, how squash grew, and how to pick the kinds of melons that were sweetest. She had had no idea they came in male and female specimens. The female ones, with their slight dimple up top, were sweeter. "That's okay," Kaju said. He sounded sad. Toward the end, even when he'd struck her, never so hard, nothing requiring a doctor, there were girls who had had it worse. He had been so terminally sad and sorry afterward that she found herself patting his hand, making shushing noises, promising they'd get through it, which of course she knew was a lie, because even then she knew that Kaju was a toxic piece of sea kelp that was going to cling and cling to her, that she needed to escape, even if it meant cutting off the limb he clung to. Still, she missed his family. Her screen was flashing with unanswered messages, and out of the corner of her eye she saw Kia Ying starting to rise. "I really have to go," she said desperately. "Please stop calling. It hurts my rating whenever someone calls back so quickly. Call your local satisfaction office, okay?" "Bae, would you just hold a moment?" His voice was getting exasperated now, bladed. "I hope you enjoy your time here," she added hurriedly. "There's a movie tonight on the screens. You can watch it in the central square. Check your phone for the bulletins." "Bae! Thanks so much. Goodbye." After work, she rode her scooter with some of the other girls to the mall downtown.
There was a military parade scheduled for the next day, which meant the government had cleared the roads in advance, and all the streets were long, glorious stretches of empty asphalt that they could ride their scooters down and feel like queens, could do zigzags all over the road if they pleased. A warm sunset light caught the steel and glass of the buildings and encased them in gold. At the mall, they ate Korean food and stopped into one of the dozens of photo parlors that rented rooms by the hour. They were full of different props and costumes, giant foam dumplings and purple gowns, cartoon cat masks and colorful parasols. A little dingy and cheap, but you could swap in and out different backgrounds. A green lagoon, a floodlit stage, a ballroom, whatever you wanted. The girls squeezed into one room and took repeated shots of one another, Bae dressed as a feudal princess, Suki as a tiger. She hadn't told anyone about Keju or about the animals. There was the time, 6 months after they had started dating, that she'd come across a dead mouse in a box in his room. It was soft and slumped and gray, stiff-limbed, front crusted with blood. Someone had partially severed one of his legs. When she'd confronted Keju, he'd said it was just a mouse. It was going to be killed as part of a school science experiment. He'd given it a few days of freedom, but he just couldn't keep it, and so he'd had to kill it. It was only humane. The explanation was disturbing, but possibly logical, and so she tried to put the thought aside. Then there was the neighbor's dog. It was a shaggy golden creature with no neck, like a shark, and eyes usually half-closed in slumber. Once, they'd been sitting in the courtyard downstairs, and she'd been nickering at it, scratching its ears. "You don't like that dog better than me, do you?" Keju had said, and when she hadn't responded fast enough, he'd planted one boot on its neck and pushed, laughing. The dog squeaked. It made a raspy noise in its throat, guttural, whining. Bae had pleaded for him to stop, and at last he did. "Relax," he said, "I wasn't going to hurt him." After that, every time he saw the dog, he kicked at it, casually, as though aiming at a stray soccer ball, just to tease her. A few months later, one of the semi-feral cats that lurked outside of their high school had been lying on the asphalt, Keju stroking it until it had startled and bitten him, drawing blood. Keju had talked jokingly of getting revenge on the cat for days, and everyone had rolled their eyes. He liked the attention, until one afternoon he'd pulled Bae aside and showed her a steak knife. "I'm going to get that cat," he said, his eyes glinting. "You're crazy," she said. "It attacked me first," he said. "It's a cat," she said. It didn't matter. He'd chase the cat around, knife in hand, alternately waggling his fingers, trying to get it to come near and lunging at it. Bae had watched him, near tears. She'd finally walked away. The next day she saw the cat, unhurt. But a week later, it disappeared. Keju didn't volunteer any information, and she didn't ask. It was easy to imagine what he would say. "We're all animals." Something stupid like that. Then there was a time at the movies when he thought she was flirting with another boy, and he'd turned mean and shaken her, savagely. That's how it began. From that day on, something changed between them. One day at lunch, in front of his friends, he'd flipped up his own shirt and said, "Look, she's as flat as I am," and laughed. A week later, she'd teased him about the way he often ran his fingers through his hair, a nervous tic of his, and he'd struck her across a cheek. Each time, he'd get flustered, apologize, occasionally weep. "I didn't mean it, you just upset me," he'd say. "You're the best thing that's ever happened to me." She wasn't brave enough to break it off with him. Instead, after she left home to pursue her ambitions as a singer, she gradually stopped answering his calls or returning his messages. Eventually, she heard that he had dropped out of school. The phone rang again at the office 2 days later. "I'm leaving tomorrow," Keju said. "I wanted to let you know." "Okay," she said, idly composing a pattern of flowers and smiley faces on her screen, which she planned to send to the next recipient who messaged her. Sometimes she made impossibly elaborate bouquets of different flowers, tulips, sunflowers, roses, peonies. She liked to send those to elderly recipients in particular, liked to imagine their wrinkled faces softening and smiling to see them. It broke up the monotony of the day. "I don't have anything else to do this afternoon," he said. "I'll wait outside your office." And then, when she didn't reply, "Don't be like that, Bay. I came a long way." She let one of her chat windows sit idle for more than a minute, considering, and her screen flashed red angrily. She swore softly under her breath. "Bay? What?" "Please, just let me buy you a coffee. I won't call you again." "You promise?" she said. "I promise." They met that evening after work in the plaza of the mall across the way. The water fountain was activated, and kids were skipping in and out of it screaming. "I never understood what was so fun about that," Bay said, just to have something to say. Now that Kaju was there, he stood silently, eyeing her. He was shorter than she remembered, and stockier. He wore cheap sunglasses and a sky blue shirt, boxy and too short. It struck her that something seemed wrong with him. And as he turned to face her, she saw that he was missing his right arm. "Oh," she said, surprised, and then stopped herself. The sleeve that would have held his right arm was folded over and fastened with a safety pin like a doll's blanket. He caught her gaze and looked away. "An accident," he said. "I see. It's been so long," she said, trying to cover her shock. "Thanks for coming," he said. "That's okay," she said uneasily, keeping her distance. "Did you want to get something to drink?" They stopped at a stall and drank a lemonade in the fading light. She paid. Standing there, he felt familiar, in the way of a distant cousin, or an old school acquaintance, full-fledged in her memory, but a stranger. She tried not to look at the blank space beside his body. "So why are you here?" she asked. "I'd never been before," he said, and she nodded as though it were an answer. She fidgeted, scanning the scene around them, half wondering if any of her co-workers were nearby watching. "Do you still keep up with anyone from school?" she asked inanely. "I keep meaning to go back to visit." For a while she had thought of visiting the music teacher who'd encouraged her talents, though enough time had passed that she wondered if he'd even remember her. Kaju didn't reply. His eyes kept crisscrossing her, absorbing her. It made her feel acutely conscious of the shape of her clothes, the way her belt held about her waist, the exposed parts of her feet and her sandals. "You look different," he said. "You look nice." She thanked him. "Kaju, what happened to you?" He was watching her steadily. Up close, she could see the stubble on his chin, the bags under his eyes. There were lines around his mouth and on his neck that hadn't used to be there. The sight of them made her feel suddenly sorrowful, aware of the miles and years that had passed. "It was a factory explosion," he said. "A fire." "I'm so sorry." She could picture it, the orange fireball going up into the sky, shaky footage shot by residents. There were accidents like that every few weeks, places that had been neglected. Factory inspectors paid off, planning studies that had never been done, always the same reasons. "The place hadn't been inspected in 4 years," he said. "We were locked in during our shift. It was a fire trap." She shook her head, sympathetically. Out of habit, she found herself wanting to tell him it was something that was being addressed, that there were government programs and new laws being drafted, but the words died on her lips. "Might have been worse," he said. "I almost didn't make it. Hid in the crawl space for hours." Fire isn't something to hide from, she thought, but she couldn't bring herself to speak. She didn't know what she could say around him anymore. After they'd parted ways, it surprised her how quickly he'd faded from her life, as did the absence of news from him from mutual friends. It occurred to her later that she had been one of very few who had been close to him, perhaps the only one. "I panicked," he said. "Didn't even notice how much time had gone by. It felt like I'd never be able to move again. He was standing with his back to the screen above the square, which was lit with a swirling orange spiral, as though the sun were rising out of his head. "Doesn't it matter that you are one of a billion plus?" an announcer was saying, an advertisement of some kind. "It doesn't matter. You are one of us." "After you cut me off, I went a little crazy." "Dropped out of school," he said. "You never told me what I did wrong." Bay opened her mouth to speak, then paused. "It was so long ago," she said. There was a steady drift of the crowd moving toward the screen. In another 20 minutes, the dance party would start. The districts held them every evening. They were free and principally attended by retirees, everyone shimmying together in a choreographed group. This week, the bulletins had said, the theme was Caribbean. "We were good together," he said. He drained his lemonade through the straw, and the sound of it made her wince. Behind him in the distance, kids chased one another, shrieking. She wondered if he was able to tie his shoes, drive a car, cut a piece of meat. "Do you ever think about those days?" he said, and reached out and cupped her face with his hand, rough to the touch. She tried not to recoil or move, and instead stared straight ahead, holding her breath. "Please don't," she said, her voice cracking. He didn't seem to hear. His hand was in her hair now, fingering her scalp. He leaned in as though for a kiss, tenderly murmuring her name until she recalled herself and jerked away. "No," she said more forcefully than she meant to. His face was that of a child who had been struck, and for a moment she regretted her reaction. But then Kaju moved away and drank from his lemonade again, and she saw his face smooth and rearrange itself, as though nothing had happened. He was proud. It was something she'd always liked about him. They watched the crowd silently. A distant sound of drumbeats was starting. Out of the corner of her eye, she could see him looking at her, but she stared determinedly ahead. "Anyway, I'm glad I got to see you," he said finally, as though the city had a set number of attractions and she was on the list. "It's nice here, isn't it?" she said, relenting. He looked beyond her. It was a pleasant scene, the kids running around, the crowds of retirees in their bright skirts and sequined tops, getting ready to dance. On the perimeter were the black-uniformed security officers, a couple of them casually talking with tourists crossing the plaza, a few speaking into walkie-talkies. "To be honest, it gives me the creeps," Kaju said. "I guess it takes getting used to," she said stiffly. She looked at the lanyard strung around his neck, its green cord and green badge, the size of dish soap, clearly identifying him as a non-resident. The photo of him was scarcely recognizable, his face sallow, too broad, its proportions badly rendered to fit the badge. It made him look like a much older man. "You should really call your local satisfaction office," she said. "I hope your dad will be okay." Kaju was silent for a few minutes, staring at the fountain. "You always thought you were too good for everything," he said. "You were going to be this great singer, remember?" She shut her eyes briefly. "I remember." "Now look at you, taking calls all day in a cubicle," he said, his voice harsh. "All alone in this big city. Really, Bay, I'm sorry for you." Strains of Caribbean music were starting to drift to them. Some of the black-uniformed police were handing out maracas. They finished their lemonade and lapsed into a strained silence, which she finally broke. "I've got to go, Kaju." There wasn't anything else to say. "Good luck with everything," she said. After they parted, Bay couldn't bring herself to go underground, not quite yet. She'd walk a while, she decided. Her parents, she thought, would have liked her to marry him. There was something quietly dependable about him. Once, when he was away on a holiday and the networks were down, he had walked 2 miles to find a place to call and say goodnight to her. "You'll never find anyone who loves you so much," she remembered her mother saying. If they'd married, too, it would have meant that Bay would have stayed at home, wouldn't have been a single girl in the capital, taking calls from who only knew. But of course it was a good job, a government job. But still. There was a bulletin on her phone that had popped up moments after they'd finished their lemonade. "Attention," it ran. "Learn the 5 things to do before bedtime to wake up refreshed." She turned her attention to the screen and watched as a beautiful woman cut the stems off a quartet of ruby red strawberries and rinsed them at the sink. A few blocks later, someone shouted and she looked up. It was Suki, sitting at the driver's wheel of a large van, window rolled down, grinning. It was an unmarked government van. Anyone could tell it was intended for the discontented, the protesters who tried to stir up trouble, usually from out of town. It had all the subtle signs, the missing license plate, the large man staring stolidly ahead in the front passenger seat, the metal grill separating Suki from her human cargo, bound for a nearby detention center. The back seat windows were tinted, but through the windshield she could see the seats were mostly filled. "Want a ride?" Suki said, gesturing to the back seat. Bay forced a laugh. "Shut up," she said, and kept walking. "Have it your way," Suki said, and stuck out her tongue, a little flip of pink. Bay smiled back and watched her drive off. She'd go home, she thought. Put her feet in some hot water. Maybe watch something. She was glad to be off work. Glad it was spring. It was good, she thought, to be young, to have a weekend, to be free. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. Be sure to listen next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Ann Jordan, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.